previously.tvpodcastnetwork.
This is our moment. We must not hesitate to seize it.
This is the Extra Hot Grape Podcast, episode 139 for the week of December 19th, 2016. I am Shaky Dictator David T. Cole, and I'm here with Defective Child Sarah D. Bunting.
Pass the milk.
Wise Prostitute Tara Ariano.
I make pronouncements and drink port.
And Fascist Fashionista Chris Huff.
Has anybody seen my brown shirt?
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the last full episode of Extra Hot Great for this year, 2016. A little bit of site business just on that schedule before we get into the meat of the episode. This is the last episode, but we are going to be recording minis for every usual release day throughout 2016. So if it's not a holiday and it's not Saturday and Sunday, fire up your podcast app and download our minis. Most of the topics have been prescribed by you, the listeners, via Twitter and Facebook.
Yeah, so we have enough minis to wrap us around to January 9th. And then after that, we will have another regular big episode by the next day. So there you go. Happy holidays. Choke on them.
Please. Speaking of dystopias, please welcome Chris Huff, who is joining us this week to talk about The Man in the High Castle. Hello, Chris.
Hello, Chris.
Hi.
Yay! Hi. We should let Chris give a little bit of his resume, what makes him particularly well-suited to comment on The Man in the High Castle. Chris, tell us.
I have a PhD in history.
La-dee-da!
I am relieved, because I thought he was going to say he was a Nazi.
Now is not the time to make quote jokes unquote about that. Anyway, I just wanted to make sure we got that in. Sarah, back to you.
Well, it is sort of an interesting time, as the Chinese curse goes, to be discussing this dystopian scripted show from Amazon Prime, I guess, that it just entered its second season last Friday. It dropped the whole season and is based on a Philip K. Dick story, novella, is that right?
Yeah.
Yes.
In which there is an alternate timeline that everyone's in which the Axis powers actually won World War II, and how things might develop. Certainly, with President-elect Trump still refusing not to tweet at Saturday Night Live and refusing to stop nominating white supremacists to his cabinet, there are some parallels to our current reality. But yeah, I was interested to see how, first of all, how many like downloads and how much streaming traffic this show would do in the second season, given our political situation. And also if they would continue doing the cool little world building details that I thought were the best part of season one. I am still only about halfway through season two. How far is everyone else?
How many did we watch?
Same.
Five?
Yeah, we're halfway through.
Okay.
Yeah, six. I got through six.
All right.
How are we feeling compared to season one? Tara, I know you sort of bailed on the first season after, what, two episodes? So.
No, I watched all of it. I mean, I watched all. I think I fell asleep in the finale. And then before we started watching this season, I went back and read the plot summary. So I know how it ended. But I watched these. I mean, the problem is partly exactly what you said. Like, I already was not that interested in it last season when it was like escapist. And now it's so... It's not escapist at all, given what has happened in our most recent election here. And so every time we're supposed to empathize with anyone, I'm just like, just kill all the Nazis. Like that's how I feel in life and how I feel about this show, honestly. So it's not that much fun for me to watch. Dave?
It's not a fun show.
No, it's
not.
It's not
supposed to be fun for you to watch.
No, I realize that.
Whether you enjoy it or not. I give you that. And that's sort of my biggest problem with this show, both in season one and continuing in season two. It's just not that being occupied by a foreign power is a, you know, situation where we're going to have a lot of laughs. And but this is really a mirthless show.
There aren't any Murphs either.
No Murphs. And I feel like it is so dour. It is so, like, even the color palette, you know, the color grading they do on the film.
Very drab.
The muted blacks, you know, like, everything from the visual to the writing is, like, consistent in a way that I think drag it down after a while. Like, I wish, it's not very dynamic, you know, in any way. You know, everything from the lead.
Which one? Because they're all kind of,
yeah.
Juliana is my biggest problem, and I think
Frank needs to shut the fuck up, in my opinion. Like, just like, stop being a pissy bitch. Like, either you're in or you're out. Anyway, sorry.
Continue. No, that if you weren't into this show in season one, I don't think season two is going to change your mind. They didn't take any opportunities to really change anything that they were doing, and maybe they don't have to. I'm sure the numbers are fine, you know, especially for Amazon, which is, you know, just kind of ramping up in a big way, so they're happy with what they can get. But I don't see anything here so far. I mean, I personally am interested in it. I love alt history stuff, or counter history, whatever you want to call it. So this is sort of like catnip. I love the little touches. Like, at one point they mentioned a Landropa, which is like this crazy, it wasn't actually a Nazi scheme, but it was like something the Nazis were kind of hoo-ha-ing about, which is like partially drain the Mediterranean by damming off the Strait of Gibraltar and then irrigating the Sahara and parts of Africa in order to, like, make that sort of the same relationship Egypt had to Rome, you know, where it was all, you know, grain from Egypt would be sent to Rome. That was sort of like their thinking, is that they would basically turn the Sahara to farmland to do that. So little touches like that I really enjoyed, and then to see how they bubble up. But Chris Huff, you're the history major who actually finished his degree. What did you think of season two so far?
I had a bit of a weird response to it, because I sat down to watch it, got 10 minutes into the first episode of the second season. I was like, I don't remember any of this.
I had
all.
The same reaction. I had to Wikipedia, like,
yeah, that's what I did.
Plot summaries, because I watched the whole thing, but I think it might just be one of those shows that's like perfectly pleasant. Yeah. I mean, you know, for a dystopian story. Yeah. Like,
no,
you enjoy watching it, but then it doesn't stay with you.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember two things. The final scene from the whole first series, and how much I hated Joe and Juliana.
Yeah.
Like, that was like a visceral response I had. And everything else went blank. So the first couple episodes, I wasn't taking it very seriously. I'm like, oh, maybe this is a lot more lighthearted. That might be not the best word, but not quite as profound as I thought it was. But then, because I've had to think a lot about this, because Tara has made me write about half the season.
So has Sarah.
I think it's it's got a lot deeper and heavier as the seasons progressed. So I'm giving some more weight to it than I thought that I would after the first two episodes. Because it really has been. I can't think of any other show where the context and how we watch it has changed so much between the first season and the second season. All of a sudden we're going, we need to pay attention to what's happening here now.
Yeah. Your first episode that you're covering for us is episode 3. And that was the one that actually had an event in it that tied back to one of the few things I did remember about season 1, which was, I won't try to say his title because I'm going to get it wrong. Smith's son.
Obergruppenführer. Yes.
Thank you. Very nice. Sort of his struggle about what he's going to do with his, as Sarah had it in her intro, the defective child, which I, as I said while we were watching it, it's kind of it's funny that people don't say that about people's bratty kids. Your child is defective. But anyway.
Just when they're screaming for Legos in the story, you mean?
Yes.
Yeah.
Your child is defective. Make it go sit in the car. Anyway, go ahead, Chris. That episode 3.
Yeah, that was the one that brought me around, was that whole scenario with Smith and his kid.
Well, he's doing, that actor is doing a great job. I think it's really a testament to the concept that, despite my disliking Juliana, Joe's new manic pixie dream Fräulein, who's fucking plying him with LSD, And Frank and Ed can both go jump off the destroyed Golden Gate Bridge for all I give a shit. But then the show will do these things like in an alternate timeline. Togomi, like, first of all, he finds a Twinkie and he's trying to eat it with chopsticks, yeah. which was like a cheap visual shot that I still loved.
Yeah.
And then he finds currency and it's a red seal note, which literally nobody else cares except my dad, who doesn't listen to this podcast. But that was like a very interesting, like, script nerd thing for them to do that I was like, oh, well, that now we know exactly when we are, or I do. No one else cares.
Which is what?
Yeah, but like
details.
When are we?
When are we?
Yeah.
Because it was a limited run.
Okay.
Of notes, mostly fives. Some of them are still in circulation, but it was 62.
Oh, okay.
We knew that from other context clues, but yeah.
Because he asks his aide to research the Cuban Missile Crisis. That's one of the things that he sort of has gotten wind of in the alternate timeline and he wants to know about.
Yeah, but I just love that they found one of those, like, of all the currency that they could use to really nail it down. And there's maybe three people that would notice that and care. And one of them is talking about it right now and is going to stop because who knows where the other two are. But yeah, it's really, it's good at that. That's what I like it for. Yeah. It's like decor porn and, you know, when you can see it, it's lit so poorly.
Chris, what is working best for you, would you say, in season two, since you've seen the most of it?
I'm really digging the alternate reality that's existed or that's been popped up in the past couple episodes in the mid five and six. I think coming at this as a historian and really digging the counterfactual aspect of it, I didn't think a whole lot about the fact that it's sci-fi or written by someone who's into sci-fi. So when that started happening with Togumi, I was like, oh, it's all in his mind. Okay. And then I was like, shit, no, it's not. This is actually real. Okay. Let's have some fun with this now. So that just kind of came out of left field for me, and I really enjoyed that. And Smith, absolutely. The guy playing Obergruppenführer Smith is just – he has his own little universe that everyone gets pulled into, and I enjoy it when they get pulled into it. And I get happy when Joe gets pushed out of it because then we don't have to see Joe anymore.
Yes.
He's kind of starting to get pulled into the Nazi hierarchy, and I want that to happen because then we can kill Nazis, and he will be one of them.
Yeah, and I love that his father is played by the notorious C Square.
I was waiting for it. There it
from
is.
Law and Order. Did you know that guy used to be married to Vera Farmiga?
No. Oh my God.
Yeah.
Joe's
it's
father.
Been a while, but
yeah. That guy's like he's a character actor. He was in Fringe as well.
Yeah.
Scandal and stuff, but he's in a notorious Law and Order episode where he plays like a gross metal guy who raped a groupie.
And inspires one of my all-time favorite Ben Stone line readings of the group's lyrics.
She ain't no lady. She a bitch.
She's my bitch.
Coming out of Michael Moriarty's face. Not right.
Well, I have one item I think we have ignored so far that we really do have to address, and that is the Smith household kitchen fridge.
Dave was in love with his fridge.
Anybody else check that thing out? So if you haven't seen I'll try to describe it. It's a like half-sized fridge from what you can see. Presenting into the kitchen is sort of like the first half of a curved surface, right? So if you imagine it's a silo, you're seeing half of it pop out. All the doors are glass, so you see everything in it. And when they open side to side, so it kind of slides back into the cupboard. As they open it, get the milk. And then the glass is sort of that very 60s, it's not frosted, but it has like almost columns of glass within the glass.
Yeah.
And it is amazing. I don't know if it was made just for this as sort of a design porn touch, you know, like kind of imagining it, or if this was an actual model fridge that existed, because it was amazing. Let's talk fridge.
What else
this
is there
has
to
been
say?
Fridge talk.
It's real. I mean, in my research on 50s consumer culture, that thing has popped up. That was part of the kind of very futuristic aspect of modern suburban life, sort of taking all the kind of rejecting the old, embracing the new. Everyone's doing well now financially. Let's all have the latest gadgets sort of thing. So they didn't make it up. I've seen that before.
Now Dave is going to have to go on a holy quest to find one that's still extant and working somewhere to drive up our electric bill.
Yeah, I'm sure it's not.
Very it can be very energy efficient.
No.
But so very beautiful. So how do we think everything's going to end? Tara, are you going to watch the rest of it now that
I don't know. It might be one of those things where I passively consume it, where it's on and I'm in the room, but I'm, you know, reading Twitter or enjoying a coloring book while Dave watches it. I don't know. The first season didn't grab me, and this one hasn't really either. And I tweeted about this earlier, not to like make Juliana the scapegoat of what makes this whole season bad. She's really annoying, though. And to me, it finally clicked for me this week, which was she's Kate from Lost. Like, she's that character where she's like just giving a lot of eyes and cheekbones and being quiet and mysterious. And it's like, you're just boring. You have nothing to say and you're bad at being a revolutionary. I don't want to watch you anymore. That's my problem with her. And Joe is even worse. So I don't know. But Dave will probably watch it.
Yes, I will watch it. I wish I could, like, you know, kind of pick and choose the ingredients that went into making this and, like, you know, make my own version of it.
Remix it, yeah.
Yeah, because it's like, almost, like, it could be so much more interesting and so much more dynamic of a show than it is. Right now, it is basically a coffee table book as a TV show. Like, you know, you go to your uncle's house and he's got the great tanks of World War II. Eastern Front, right? And you're like, oh, I guess I'll take a look at this. And you're like, oh, yeah, there's a guy. And then, like, there's one shot of a tank blowing up. You're like, ooh. And then, like, you know, 20 more pages of wrenches used in the Soviet line. That's sort of this show, you know? Like, there's glimpses of very interesting things, but often they're hampered by lackluster performances and characters.
I mean, we've said this before about shows that have large ensemble casts, but it's so often the case that producers don't know what parts of their shows are actually good, and so they're all weighted wrong. Like, I would have loved a show that was just about Togomi going back and forth and, like, fuck all the other stuff, like, just keep it in San Francisco, but that's not what we got, so well.
Yeah, no, agree.
Chris?
Also, just one last thing.
Okay.
Does Togomi remind anyone else of Lane Price?
Yeah, he does.
Is it just the glasses?
And his facial expressions too. But we should let Chris, I mean, Chris has to watch it to the end because we're making him. But Chris, what are your final thoughts on the season thus far?
My final thoughts.
Hopes, dreams.
I had another refrigerator related comment to piggyback on Dave there.
Listening.
Although it's not in the Smith household, it's in the Togomi household in the alternate reality. Because I've watched it a couple times. There's a lot of Goulden's mustard in that kitchen.
Yes. And I counted four things of Tabasco. There was one on the kitchen table peeking out from behind something else. There was one in the fridge. And then there was a big one and a small one in the pantry. Four bottles of Tabasco.
Okay.
Not
because I saw
tasters. This family got it.
Yeah. There was like a jar of mustard on the door, another, a big one inside the refrigerator, and like one or two more in the pantry. Yeah. So I was like, that's a lot of mustard.
How do we fit in mustard?
But yeah, no, I'll definitely be watching to the end, particularly since Juliana seems to bother me a lot less than she bothers you guys, and her new role in the alternate reality.
Yes.
Seems kind of interesting.
Yeah. It's all I got from the alt history right now.
Sarah, your final thoughts?
Yeah, I'm going to watch to the end, but I've sort of accepted that this is not a show that, like, when season three comes out, I will once again have to, like, Google what happened in season two, because it just doesn't, it should stick better than it does, I think, given the concept, but it doesn't, and I've accepted that.
But I think that's true of a lot of binge, a lot of shows that all come out at once, I feel like that's the case, because you watch them so fast, it's like you have time to, like, you know, you don't have a week to continue thinking about what you've just watched, you know, or like, because you're just having it all in a clump to the point where, like, even in these, when you get flashbacks in one episode to shit that just happens, like, we just watched it. Your show just all came out. Of course, we know exactly what happened. You don't have to show us again. This is an alias, you know.
Anyway. Yeah. Except then they should have done that at the beginning of the first episode of season two, and they didn't. And I was like, who even are these people? Do I know that guy?
Yeah. I'm surprised when they do these, like, it isn't standard operating procedure on the first episode to have
previous
a recap.
Last season on blah, blah. Yeah.
Because especially when you're, as you say, you're dealing with this, where you can have almost like a full year between last episode of the last season and the first episode of the new season. You're like, ugh? And then, you know, Amazon's got that X-ray thing, but I don't do that. You know, I just need it on the screen or else I'm not going to consume it. Like, I remember Orange is the New Black came out, and I was like, I don't, like, I know it's a prison, and there's ladies, but I don't remember anything else. And for the first season, the first episode, they just assumed, you know, as continuity. I was like, ah, just like, yeah. And I feel like a TV show, and especially in this new streaming era, should be like a program. Like, yeah, there's instruction books out there and tutorials, but if you do it right, I shouldn't need it.
Yeah.
You know, I should know how to use Microsoft Word or whatever. Like, it should be apparent, you know what I mean? And I feel like it's the same mm-hmm. way with the show. And if you can't, you know, if you don't want to rewrite it into your first episode, which I understand, get your network to remind people what, you know, of what was going on for your first episode. That's
Make like a 5-minute webisode, and then it's there for us to watch. I agree.
All right.
Oh, that wonderful segue. Last Blotter Presents of the Year, and I'm thrilled to say that Unsolved Mysteries, speaking of Amazon Prime, will now be streaming the Farinasodes of the show, and the Robert Stackisodes are coming in 2017. I'm very excited. I shouldn't be that excited because there are more than 600 total episodes of the show, but... As eagle-eared listeners will recall, my husband was once in one of these and has no idea when it was, didn't meet the host, knows he was a cop in it, and I've been watching them. And then I'll, like, delete a whole batch from the DVR, and then he'll get a residual check and we'll have missed it. So, fine-tooth comb, me and Unsolved Mysteries, here we go. So yes, that is on Amazon Prime. Farinasodes available now. Stackisodes to come next year.
Before you move on, can I ask a question about residual checks? And I'll try to frame this in a way that's not too personal. If you get a residual check for an episode of Unsolved Mysteries and you decide to go out for dinner that night, what sort of dinner are you getting for a residual check from a 20-year-old Unsolved Mysteries?
They're $40. So,
okay. Hey, that's not bad.
That's not bad.
Yeah.
I've seen people like that I follow on Instagram will put like, they'll put up pictures of their residuals and it'll be like 16 cents or something for like an episode that aired in, you know, Singapore or whatever.
So you could go over to that Middle Eastern restaurant that's in your neighborhood.
Yes.
And get a nice little,
That place is good.
Couple dishes and a bottle of wine. Yeah. All right.
Yes,
thanks.
Indeed. And some baklava. Before we move on to Around the Dial, I would also like to mention that speaking of, true crime show marathons. I will have a piece coming later this week to our website, previously.tv, about your best options for catching up on streamable/downloadable crime shows from the past year over the holidays. Killing Season, Case of JonBenet Ramsey, Amanda Knox on Netflix. I'll have a list of stuff that you can use to avoid friends and family over the holidays.
Did you include any mention of my Killing Season dream?
No.
I'll just mention it now because it's so ridiculous. this is how much TV permeates my life for you, the listener and reader of previously.tv. On Thursday night, I dreamed that Rachel and Joshua from The Killing Season had a baby, and that in season two of The Killing Season, it was like kind of in the background of like some of their setup shots, and that Sarah and I were like, it was a topic of discussion for me and Sarah. We were like, that fucking baby, we gotta get rid of it. That's all.
Wow.
Yeah.
Keep that's me crazy. I love that.
This is me in Tara's dream, but it would also be me in real life.
Yeah. It's very appropriate.
I regret to say the baby in my dream did not have a gray streak in the front of his or her hair like Rachel, because that would have been really cool. But anyway.
Oh.
That's all.
All right. It's time to go around the dial. Tara, you're first up.
Well, Netflix also dropped another fucking show this week. On the 16th, it dropped a new show called The OA. It's from Britt Marling and Val Batmunglij, who is a writer-director. She also writes on the movies that they have made together, which include The Sound of My Voice and The East. Dave and I watched The East. It was good. This is not for me. Well, the story is that Britt Marling's character, Prairie Johnson, disappeared 7 years ago, and then she comes back, and she's found because someone happens to be filming while she, like, runs across a bridge and jumps off it. She survives. And in the hospital, she doesn't want to talk about where she was, and she doesn't want to be touched either. And she has these weird scars on her back. And also when her parents show up, she seems really weirded out by them. And it turns out that it's because when she disappeared, she was blind. So she's seeing them for the first time. Her sight has come back. She doesn't want to talk about that either. So, I mean, I feel like I only watched the first episode of the eighth. It was a feature length installment. It was 90 minutes. And I was sort of with it for the, you know, most of it, because I, you know, the story seems to be like, what is the mystery at the center of it is what happened to her. And she's come back talking all kinds of like what sounds like culty talk, like, you need to get back to your motivation of what made you want to be a teacher and blah, blah. You and this student are acting out a play that's been taking place across dimensions and that kind of stuff. So you're like, what actually was her deal? And Chelsea says things like, we all died more times than I can count. And then what happens is she gathers this kid in the neighborhood that she sort of made a friendship with and asks him to collect her five people who are strong and brave and whatever to go and meet in this house that's under construction so she can tell them her story. And then she's like, I was born in Russia in 1987. And it's like, oh, for fuck's sake. And then it would cut over to this other story. And it's like, my father, the oligarch, and he made me go in the frozen water. And then she got in a bus crash and she drowned. And that's how she lost her vision. But then there's like a dimensional thing where you don't know if it's a dream or it's real. And like this gypsy is reaching through space into this like pond that she's in. What? Fucking Dave. Exactly. As soon as that happened, I was like, I'm out. And I've realized something about me, which is I just can't do sci-fi stories like this anymore. Like where it's almost interesting. And then it's like, just goes right off the road. And you're like, well, anything could happen now. Like, yep. Honestly, and I hate to keep bringing it up, but like starting with Under the Dome, which would have been a great story of like, even if all they limited it to was someone put a dome on this town, what happens now? Like, that's enough of a sci-fi exactly. element where it's like, okay, then what do real people in this situation do until you get them into them? Well, now they're in cocoons underground and there's caves and everyone's mind melded. Like, fuck off. Like, no, I don't want to watch these stories anymore. Like, if this was a cult story, if this was like Martha, Marcy, May, Marlene, the TV series, I would be 100% about it. And if it was like,
totally,
you know, part of it is sci-fi element, but we, you know, mostly it's the real world, like a la Humans, which I keep pointing to as like the good example of how to do a story like this. Like, yes, but if it's like, we're making up our own mythology from scratch, we're dumping you in this universe and literally anything could happen, and essentially magic and sci-fi are like indistinguishable, I can't care. Like, there's too much TV. I can't care anymore.
It's a corollary to my time travel face shifting, shape shifting, you know, law, which is as soon as you introduce that, there's no rules and there's no tension, there's no stakes.
Yeah.
Like, because so, anything could be reversed. It's like comic books. So and so died. Well, you know they're coming back in, you know, 3 months.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, like, Britt Marling's a really great actor, and I loved watching her in The East, which I thought was a really interesting movie because it stayed in the real world. But like, by the time we got to that, at the end of that hour and a half, it was like, I know I can't commit to this. Like, so I will say Joe, our esteemed former colleague, did watch all of it this week, and he fully had said on Twitter, he called it hokum, but he said it was the kind of hokum that worked on him. So like, if this is the kind of thing you like, maybe you'll like this. For me,
in other
like,
news, people are still using the word hokum, and I'm so pleased that it's Smooth Joey Apollo.
Yes. So I don't know. There's too much television for me to be able to commit to something like this, where it's like, I don't trust that when it gets to the end, I will be happy about the journey that I took with it. So no. But check it out if any of this sounds interesting to you. It's on Netflix. And for my plug, I will just mention we have a couple of swarms of coverage going on at previously.tv right now. Of course, The Man in the High Castle, which we mentioned up top, which Chris is all over. You're doing four or five of them.
Four.
Okay. A lot of Chris Huff in that swarm. And we also just wrapped up our swarm of Fuller House, which I'm always so touched when we do it because people really get earnest about it. People are very serious really about it. So the coverage of that has been really adorable. So check out both of those at previously.tv.
Chris Huff, your turn.
Okay. I have gotten on the Abigail Spencer train this week. Because I just started watching Rectify, because this is how I watch TV now. Like literally, if you guys do a podcast, like a themed podcast of what was great in TV 4 years ago, I would be the perfect guest. Because that's about where I'm at with most TV these days. So I got on Rectify, which, you know, you guys have talked tons about. And it's as brilliant as everyone says it is. I've just started season 4, which just wrapped up, I think, this week, right?
Yep.
Yes, it did. Yes.
So it's brilliant, of course. The thing I really liked about it, though, as a former Georgia resident, is that it nails life in Georgia. It is the most spot-on portrayal I have seen yet of what it's like to live in the modern semi-rural South. Particularly Teddy, who I think he's the best character on the show. Teddy, agreed. Like if you want to, you know, if you really want to understand like what a Trump voter thinks, like watch this show and pay really close attention to Teddy.
Yeah.
Because that's who he is.
Ray McKinnon, who created the show, is from Georgia. So I assume all the specificity comes from his own memories of that, his experience of growing up there.
Yes. And whoever did the soundtrack, I'm positive I stood next to the guy at like 30 different shows when I was in Atlanta. Cause it's like, I'm listening. I'm like, Allison, come over here. Listen to this song that they just slid into the soundtrack. It's just like this perfection of alt country Americana, obscure bands that some dude who's into it and about my age would know. So I'm sure if I ever met him, I'm like, oh, you, yeah, I bought you a beer at that Drive-By Trucker show 5 years ago. So yeah, Rectify, brilliant. And it actually has got me giving Abigail Spencer a little bit more of leeway with Timeless, which everyone should watch, although it's on hiatus right now, but get caught up.
Yeah.
It's maddening sometimes. It literally is.
What an endorsement.
Both the best and worst. Yeah. Well, no, it's both. It alternates between some of the just really, really great episodes and then them just phoning it in. And depending on which one you watch, you can be like, this is great, or wow, they could do so much. Plus, Dave, it's time travel. And it's time travel where no one's thought anything through about how it's supposed to work.
I have to admit, I am a little intrigued by the idea that somebody is creating a universe, but they're doing it almost in real time while making the show. It sounds like such a clusterfuck.
I mean, we will have time coming up in the holidays. Maybe you want to catch up on the episodes because we haven't watched it since the premiere.
Yeah, I would have to. I would get frustrated with it quickly because, like, I really, whenever I read counter history, alt history, counterfactual history, I really need it to be full of real details and, like, kind of almost like I'm reading a textbook from the era. That's the shit I like. And that's why I kind of like with Man in the High Castle is very interested in it because it was a very, you know, serious production. Whereas Timeless is, you know, is like the Indiana Jones version of that, right? So I'd have to get a short list of Chris Huff's choices.
Yeah.
Well, I love it because it got a little slack in the beginning because they only came up with about 3 rules for time travel that, oh, this should be easy to stick to. Then by episode 5, I'm like, no, oh, they're breaking those 3 simple rules.
Yeah, like, really, you can't go back to stick to this. To the same point in time unless you really need to, guys.
Yes.
Sarity Bunting, take us out.
Intervention is back. I'm not exactly sure what Annie thinks they're doing premiering these things in December, but definitely watching Intervention and Hoarders. Intervention seems to be not shifting its focus exactly, but first of all, it seems to have stopped doing the 2 addicts per episode thing, which is good because that was always a little like confusing and jarring. And they're also definitely reaching out to addicts from past shows in the follow-up segment who have had relapses. That definitely seems to be a message that they're trying to send to the viewership, that's like not normal, but just like non-fatal, not unusual part of the recovery process. So that's sort of interesting. And they're also using a past subject of the show as an interventionist. Again, her name is Sylvia, and she is adorable. I always love it when she's on there because she knows exactly what to say. They use her for the total toughest cases, and they always are like, okay. And they go because she's great. So that is back, and we are covering it at previously.tv. And my plug is that if you love this podcast, you will like a little podcast I like to call Mark and Sarah Talk About Songs. That's because that's its name. And we have our Chris Mastass episode that is currently available on iTunes. And our last episode of the year will be coming up this Thursday. So 2 days from now, as you're listening to that, we would love to have you join the listenership of that. And there is a TV link in the Christmas episode. We discuss a Mariah Christmas song, and Mariah has a TV show on right now, which Chris's wife was unfortunately subjected to in her excellent new show Fact Sheet. And that is my plug. Mark and Sarah Talk About Songs.
All right, everybody, it is time for the canon. Our guest, Chris Huff, is presenting this week. Take it away, Chris.
All right. My selection for consideration to the canon is from that quintessentially 1980s family comedy, Family Ties. Family Ties premiered in September 82 and ran for 7 seasons, ending in 89. The show followed the Keaton family, parents Stephen and Elise, played by Michael Gross and Meredith Baxter Burney, and their 3 precocious children. Son Alex, played by, of course, Michael J. Fox, daughter Mallory, which was Justine Bateman, and the youngest preteen Jennifer, played by Tina Yothers, or Yothers. Family Ties was a major part of NBC's killer mid-1980s Thursday night sitcom lineup. This was must-see TV before the phrase must-see TV had been created. For 3 glorious seasons from 84 to 87, TV viewers had a solid 2-hour comedy block made up of The Cosby Show, Family Ties, Cheers, and Night Court. Family Ties occupied several time slots during the first season and a half, but in the middle of its second season, found its Thursday night home at 8:30, bookended by The Cosby Show and Cheers. And this position certainly helped its popularity. While it did respectable numbers before that move, during seasons 2, 3, and 4, it ranked in the top 5 and was the number 2 show for 2 of those seasons. The premise of the show was simple. Hip parents, square kids. Stephen and Elise are products of the liberal 1960s, while the kids represented popular stereotypes of 1980s suburban youth culture. Alex is a young Republican and committed capitalist, while Mallory is a typical consumption-driven valley girl. She cares far more about boys and shopping than grades. My selection for the canon is the 6th episode from the 2nd season, Speed Trap. In this episode, Alex, feeling the pressure of doing well on the last midterm exams he will take before he applies to Harvard, convinces Mallory to get him some diet pills from her friend Effie. That's right, Effie.
Thank you.
Alex certainly understands what he is doing is wrong, but with his future hanging in the balance, he decides to take the pills anyway, with the expected consequences. He quickly runs through the initial supply and convinces Mallory to get more pills. She does this for him, but when she refuses to hand them over, he rummages through her purse to get them. The ride comes to a sudden and jarring halt when Stephen figures out what Alex has been doing the night before the final midterm exam. Alex throws the pills away, promptly falls asleep, and misses the exam the next day. There are several reasons why I think this episode deserves a place in the canon. First, this is an Alex P. Keaton-centric episode. Let's face it. The success of Family Ties can be largely chalked up to the popularity of Alex. While the creators initially intended the focus to be on Stephen and Elise, this shifted early in the first season when it became clear that the audiences responded strongly to Michael J. Fox's portrayal of the necktie-wearing, briefcase-carrying Alex. Alex P. Keaton is, to put it simply, one of the most iconic TV characters from the 1980s. Fox's work on the show was rewarded with 3 consecutive Emmys for Outstanding Lead Actor in a Comedy Series, repeatedly beating out Ted Danson, Harry Anderson, and Bob Newhart. In the following clip, we get a glimpse of Fox's acting chops as the scene shifts from lighthearted family comedy territory into serious drama.
Great news. Great news. I got my term paper on Hoover back from Mr. Wilkinson. A+.
Nice work, Alex.
Look at this. Look what he wrote on the front.
an incredibly well-argued thesis. I voted for Roosevelt 4 times. Thank you for showing me the error of my ways.
I also got a 92 on my economics final and an A on my English term paper. Does anybody have any laundry they want me to do?
Alex, are you feeling all right?
Never better.
You just seemed a little hyperactive.
Oh, what you're seeing here is simply my natural boyish exuberance, that's all. It was bound to emerge eventually.
I just worry about you, that's all.
Ah, mommy. Not to worry. I'm gonna go, I'm gonna have a shower. When I come back down, I'll make myself some dinner, okay? Did you get more pills from Effie?
Yes, Alex, I did.
Good. Well, where are they?
I'm not giving them to you, Alex. You've been taking them all week and you've been acting very weird.
Weird? Weird? Do you mind giving me an example of this alleged weirdness in my recent behavior?
All right, why the sudden interest in Jennifer's dollhouse?
It's not a sudden interest at all. I've been concerned for a while that her dolls were a little cramped, so I built an annex. a little more breathing room for Molly and whatever the hell the other one's name is.
I'm not giving you any more pills, Alex.
Mallory, I've got the biggest test of my life coming up. I just want you to give me a couple more pills to get me by, that's all. And then that's the end, over, finito.
No, you should be able to study without them.
Oh, I don't believe this. A lecture and study habits from the C-minus poster girl. Come on, Mallory, I'm not asking you for a dozen. Just one. Maybe two. How many you got?
No, Alex. Alex, that's mine! Give it back!
In a second, Mallory, in a second.
Alex, you have no right to do this!
Thanks.
Don't ever speak to me again.
Oh, lighten up, will ya? Oh, and Mallory, you know, if you're thinking of telling Mom and Dad about this, you just keep in mind, you're not exactly innocent here either.
Oh, and let's not forget, of course, that Michael J. Fox is Canadian. Not trying to sway anybody here, but I thought it was worth doing.
We know.
The plot line of this episode also serves as an excellent example of the core tension between the two generations that defined much of the show. An important appeal of Family Ties is the way that it explored, to varying degrees, the shift in America from the liberalism of the 1960s to the conservatism of the 1980s Reagan years. Stephen and Elise serve as the embodiment of the 1960s. They supported civil rights, protested against the Vietnam War, took drugs, and embraced feminism. Alex, on the other hand, represents the selfishness and greed that came to define the 1980s. He is, in a slightly sanitized way, a Gordon Gekko in the making. While not studying, we can easily see Alex sitting down to watch an episode of Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous. It is the job of Stephen and Elise to rein in the excesses of Alex's conservative tendencies. In the following clip, we hear this dynamic in action as Alex, agitated as he comes down off his speed habit, chastises Elise for allowing preteen Jennifer to watch a documentary about reproduction.
Is the Miracle of Life on yet?
Just started.
What I miss?
The sperm cell just joined up with the egg cell.
What's that?
That's the inside of a woman's uterus, honey.
Anyone famous?
I don't know. Have to wait till the credits. Hey, Alex, good day at school?
Yeah.
You do well on your tests?
Fine, I did fine.
How are your papers?
What is this, the Inquisition?
Oh, Alex, who do you think you're talking to?
I'm sorry. The test went fine. I got an A- on my term paper. I'm just tired, that's all. Have you seen Mallory?
No.
Alex, you're interrupting fertilization.
What is this trash you're watching?
This isn't trash. Jennifer and I have been planning on watching this for weeks.
It's a miracle of life. They show how babies are made.
The stork brings babies, Jennifer. You're not supposed to know otherwise till you're 12 years old.
Alex, what are you doing?
I will not allow this smut in my house.
This is not your house. This is our house. That is not smut, and I don't like the way you're acting.
Oh, well, maybe I don't like the way you're acting.
Okay, Alex, I don't know exactly what's going on here, but I don't like it. You go on up to your room, and don't you come down. You can be a little more civil.
While the conflict between the generations is perhaps the more well-known aspect of the show, it's the resolution of that conflict that is the real point of Family Ties. Ultimately, this is a family comedy, and like all great dom-coms, its point is to reinforce how the bonds of family overcome our individual failings, and that no matter what, families look after each other. In this idealized TV world, parents educate far more than they punish. Again and again, Stephen and Elise forgive Alex and their other kids their shortcomings and failings. Even when Alex is in danger of becoming a drug addict, he is not punished, but counseled by Stephen, as we hear in this clip.
Alex, how many hours have you slept this week? I don't know. Four. 4 hours all week.
So I've been peppy, so what?
You haven't been peppy, Alex. You've been crazed.
Peppy, crazed. Tomato, tomato.
Have you been taking amphetamines?
No. No, me? No way, Dad. Not me.
Alex, don't lie to me.
All right, okay, I admit it. I borrowed a few from Mallory's friend Effie. Okay?
No, it is not okay.
Look, Dad, I just needed them to get me through this week. Look, I'll prove it to you, okay? See? These are all of them in the garbage. Gone. Taking my last one.
That is not the point, Alex. You shouldn't have been taking them in the first place, no matter how much you had to do.
Dad, they work. They help me. I've gotten more done this week than I ever thought possible. You got to admit it, Dad. The stuff works.
I know what it does. I used it myself when I was in school.
Oh. Okay, then how can you get mad at me?
This isn't a question of my being mad at you, Alex. It's much more complicated than that. Look, I'm your father, and right now, I see you taking a risk with something you know nothing about. Now, this is a dangerous, addictive drug you're dealing with. And nothing else matters to me except stopping you from taking it.
You don't have to worry. I'm done with it.
We're not done talking, Alex. We'll talk more in the morning.
Finally, this episode deserves a place in the canon, not just because it stands as an excellent representation of the core elements of Family Ties, but because it is one of the better examples of the ways in which 1980s TV addressed the war on drugs.
Why don't we all clear out of here and let Alex get some sleep? We'll talk more about this later when you wake up.
From the looks of you, that should be about Thursday. Look awful, Alex.
How can I do this, Mallory? I was out of control. It was like it wasn't even me. Like it was somebody else. Very scary, Mallory.
Scary for me, too. I didn't know who you were. It was like you were a different person.
Well, the old Alex is back.
I never thought I'd say this, but I'm glad to see you.
Ronald Reagan made the war on drugs a central part of his presidency. While he was busy pushing legislation that favored incarceration over treatment, First Lady Nancy Reagan did her part with her Just Say No campaign, as in, when somebody asks you to do drugs, just say no. The campaign is largely considered a joke today, and rightly so. But the discussion about the dangers of drug use, particularly the danger it represented to suburban middle-class white teenagers, was everywhere in American culture, including primetime sitcoms. Nancy Reagan made appearances in episodes of Different Strokes and Punky Brewster as part of the campaign. And while she is thankfully absent from this episode of Family Ties, her message of how drugs can quickly spin you out of control isn't, as we heard in that clip from Alex. So there it is. That's my argument for why Family Ties episode Speed Trap should be in the canon. And one final point, Michael J. Fox is Canadian.
Let me just say for the record, the one thing you never have to do is tell a Canadian who's Canadian. We fucking know. We'll tell you.
You also don't have to tell anyone else because he says sorry like 58 times in this episode. We'll talk about it tomorrow. Oh, will ya?
Yeah. Yeah, whatever Ohio quote. Yes, he's well, I have a couple of points about this. One is that the idea of building this anti-drug message around good kid wants to get more work done is really something. But, you know, as someone who, like, even later in adulthood heard about what Adderall can do for adults who don't have ADD and was like, it's like some of this was.
Wait, what does it do?
It just makes you really focused.
Oh, okay.
It makes you, like, not have to sleep as much and you can get more done, all right. Supposedly.
All right.
I have never taken Adderall to get more work done. I do not have ADD. But anyway.
That's a great name for something that makes you do more work.
Adderall?
Adderall.
Yeah. Anyway. This is the angle on the story, though, is, you know, cute. Obviously, you couldn't do like Alex goes on, starts doing cocaine or something.
Yeah, right. You remember
a lot.
But do you remember like a decade earlier, like the after school specials, you know, and all the nighttime dramas of the period, you know, like the cliche was the guy on the roof. I can fly.
Yes.
You know, like, you know,
Helen Hunt going through a closed window.
Sure. Yeah. Yep.
Angel Dusted is the name of that one. Enjoy.
Yeah. But yes, this is way anticipates the I'm so excited, I'm so excited, I'm so scared episode of Saved by the Bell, which is essentially the same storyline of like a good kid doing speed because she has so much homework to do. But anyway, a couple of critiques. One is when they play Monopoly in the episode, Alex, first of all, it's his role and he like pitches the dice across the room because he throws them too hard because he's already high. And then he goes over and says it's double threes, but does he get a second roll? No, they just go on to the next person. That is not Monopoly.
Also, point of order, those weren't the die that came in the box.
They were not.
You know, they were black instead of white dice. And if, I don't know, I mean, it's not a rule, but I always said that, you know, if the dice are not on the table, they don't, it doesn't
count.
That's
right. That was our rule.
Correct.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Because you don't know, because only one person is going to go and retrieve them. Yes. So they could say anything.
Yeah.
Never trust the other players.
Mallory's outfits are amazing.
Yes.
Agree.
When it opens, she's in this like chambray jumpsuit that has like rolled up camp sleeves with like the tabs that hold the rolls in place. And pointless like pockets sideways over the boobs.
If I may, to paint a picture, I thought it looked like she was like trying to construct a flying squirrel dress because it had like webbings underneath her armpits and stuff.
Yeah, she's base jumping, as Sarah said.
Yeah, there's these like Winchester House straps and zippers, and it looks like she's jumping out of a plane in a Kaja Gugu video, which she probably was.
Winchester House straps.
Yeah,
that is amazing.
It has a built-in belt as well. I was gonna make Dave back it up and like so that I could take a picture of it, and then I was like, I'm just gonna do a Google image search. Of course, it was like the first thing that came up when I Googled Family Ties Mallory. So if you want to see this, go to Instagram.com/Tara Ariano and you can see that and the other t-shirt that she wears in a later scene in the Monopoly scene, in fact, where she's got like, or no, that's later. In a later episode, in a later scene, she wears this Japanese inspired top with like weirdly puffed sleeves and it's got like all kanji on the back. She really turns it out in this episode. My main thing that I thought stuck out in a bad way the most was the talk about the off-screen Effie, the diet pill needer who is never seen. And there's a lot of talk about like Alex is going to have to date her in exchange for getting the pills and like, ooh, having to date a fat girl, gross. That this off-screen character has no dignity. It was it was very 80s, but it's something where it's like, I don't think you would see something like that in a family sitcom today. Like there's just more sensitivity to that kind of issues, which is good. But you're right. Alex is Michael J. Fox as Alex is really great in this episode. He also gets a lot of physical comedy that it's hard to talk about in podcast form, but like jumping off the landing of the stairs. so many sneakers in the air. He's great and so cute when he was that young. Those cheekbones, my God. Anyway, Sarah.
First of all, I'd like to say, Professor Huff, this is an excellent submission.
Yes.
Extremely well structured and such a good argument for why there should be at least a family ties in the canon. Here's the thing for me. Yeah. This is not the one. The show, I feel like, first of all, the very special episode-ishness of it, like that part, I think they handle quite well. I think it's very balanced. And I love Mallory's outfits. I love watching Michael J. Fox of that era and just like what an ear he had for being the center of that show just immediately and how he very seldom overplayed. But I feel like, and I'm including other Family Ties, very special episodes in this, I feel like they had a better ear usually for the pacing, that this felt at times very slow, that Justine Bateman is bad in this, like it's sort of a thankless role that she's given. And some of the writing for her doesn't make sense. Like, why did you get more pills from Effie if you had no intention of giving them to Alex in the second place? Like, that is weird. I mean, they needed it to set up the like purse grabbing thing, but it just didn't quite work for me. And there's like, it's just off. Like the pacing of it is off. And then the melodrama at the end, it's sort of like, ooh, with the studio audience. Like I wasn't loving it. I wasn't loving his monologues to himself. The show usually did a much better job and was much more like, not hammy, but like, I don't know. Like there was that like Norman Lear pace and like set up punchline that was very consistent in this show. And you sort of forget Michael Gross, especially like how dry he was, kind of being like straight man, and how willing he was to make a fool of himself, like the Sunflower Girl episode. Like, I really hope he won an Emmy for that at some point. But yeah, this, I was excited to watch this. This show has mostly held up. Like there are certain ways that it's very dated, and I think if they had it to write now, even as a period piece, they wouldn't have him have a Nixon photo next to his bed, even though I did like that bit. But yeah, it just didn't quite work for me. Like I think you could slot in another episode and use almost the same interstitial arguments about what makes the show and what makes the show important and lets it hold up until whatever the little brat's name was, Andrew, came along. Bonsall. Until it got, you know, little kid-itis in the later seasons of the show. But this particular episode was not fun for me to watch. Dave.
I would agree with what you said. I would say this very special episodes either for me need to be totally bonkers and outrageous or like dealt with more deftness than we see here. Like on the earlier end of the spectrum, that fucking Punky Brewster episode with the fridge that we did, that's like, that's that one end of the spectrum, right? And, you know, the 80s were feeling this out. And I feel like, you know, they kind of went all over the map. But you're right, Sarah, the pacing of this is a little off. There seems to be no throughput on sort of the escalation of taking these drugs. Like it just seemed very flatlined. One thing about the whole Nancy Reagan thing is that here it was called Just Say No, right? I remember back when I was a student at this time in Canada, we got these pins for the equivalent Canadian copycat program, which was no thank you, no thank you, no thank you.
What?
Yes, which was the most Canadian.
Oh, how Canadian.
My God.
Yes.
That must have been Ontario only because I do not remember that at all.
Yeah, they gave out pins in school that you wear. It says no thank you.
Oh, shit.
Yeah.
And then in parentheses, I'm sorry.
A couple other stray observations. The credits, you know, when they start and it's like the outline of the painting, you know, the pencil part of it, immediately the first stroke is way out of the lines. Couldn't they like get that right? Didn't they have multiple copies of the pencil outline part? And the other one is when Alex comes into the house and Jennifer and his mom is watching the Miracle of Life, and he goes off about the storks and all that kind of stuff. If you listen to the background, the show actually continues, which is victory one, because a lot of the times suddenly that whatever they started watching will cease to exist when characters start talking, but it actually has dialogue in it, which is, those two things are very rare. Usually the TV just ceases to exist when other people start talking. So I thought that was a nice little touch. But I do agree. The pacing was weird. And for me, this wasn't really so much a very special episode. It was just like slightly special because it just wasn't bonkers enough.
Yeah.
Yeah. So with that, let's put it to a vote. Tara, Arianna.
I have to agree with Dave and Sarah, partly because the consequences of what he does are he gets great grades on all of the work that he does complete, and then he just sleeps through one exam. Like, you kind of want someone to like run off the road or something at least. So I don't know. As a cautionary tale, it's not as cautionary as it could be. The worst thing he has to do is date a fat girl. So I'm going to vote no. But thank you.
Sarah D. Funting.
We don't even see him date the fat girl. Also, don't name characters Effie in the 1980s. That always drives me crazy. Like, Seventh Heaven used to do that too. Like, my new friend from sixth grade, Vera. It's not a thing. Sorry. It was such an excellent argument. Please bring it back for another Family Ties episode, but this one is a no.
Yeah, I'm also going to say no, but that was like the best structured canon argument I think I've heard in a long,
academia,
long time.
Academia, folks. It works.
I'm sorry to tell you. Family Ties, Season 2, Episode 6, known as Speed Trap. That's another thing we didn't discuss, that title. It's kind of great. You're, unfortunately, not inducted into the extra Hot Great Canon.
Americans love a winner.
Yeah.
And will not tolerate a loser.
No.
It is time for the winner and loser of the week. Tara has our winner.
I have a trio of winners. Some casting news this week. Molly Ringwald is going to be playing Archie Andrews' mother on the CW's gritty new reboot of Riverdale. Which means
stay out of Riverdale.
At some point, she boned with Luke Perry because he's playing Archie's dad. So that's happening. Wow. Also, Sonequa Martin-Green from The Walking Dead is going to be a lead on Discovery, the Star Trek show on CBS All Access. And finally, realizing she's in the twilight of her career as a feature film actress and deciding maybe now it's time for me to do a TV show a la Laura Linney, Julia Roberts has been cast in the lead of the adaptation of Maria Semple's latest book, Today Will Be Different. Doesn't have a network attached yet, but I'm sure they're all jizzing their pants over the possibility of having an Oscar-winning actress headline a show on their network, or more likely, possibly streaming service. So congratulations to all of them.
And loser of the week?
If it means that she's not going to be doing the... those terrible perfume commercials where her butt has obviously been CGI enhanced, I am all for it. After all those queens of the small screen, my loser is the County of Kings. Homeland Season 6 is set in Brooklyn. Fuck off, Carrie.
Maybe her new assignment is to try to disrupt terror plots involving very icy sidewalks. Never forget.
I haven't.
Speaking of things you'll never forget, do you know what time it is? Come on, you remember.
No, I don't.
It's game time.
Oh! Yay!
All right, everybody, this is the second game time of this season. Tara won last week. Today's game time comes from Rob Hartman.
Ooh,
and
yay!
It is called, and here's a first for game time, it is called First Name Basis, which was also the name of another game we did a few months ago, but this is not the same type of game.
Okay.
Just so you know. Rob Hartman writes, in my fantasy world, all TV shows are shot at the same big studio, and the new temp security guard only knows actors' first names. So he sends them all to the wrong sets, and hijinks ensue. Lisa Kudrow ends up where Lisa Vanderpump should be and plays the Beverly Hills Housewives, a rendition of Smelly Cat. In First Name Basis, players have to figure out which two actors with the same first name have switched places.
Okay.
Actors from current and classic shows are included. Actors only appear once in the game,
okay,
but shows may come up more than once.
Got it.
All gotcha. Right. Makes sense?
Yes.
And of course, Rob earns himself an extra credit for his troubles, redeemable for an extra hot, great mini topic of his choosing.
And the steal meals for the value guests are still in play. Is that correct?
That is correct. There's two of them.
Okay.
All right.
So let's throw it to Picky to see who's going first.
We will start with Sarah.
I'll say, we're going to go Sarah, Tara, and then Chris. Are we ready to play first name basis?
Sure are.
All right.
Yay. Tara.
I mean, Sarah. I already got it wrong. Very first one.
Great start.
Here you go. Woo. So you are naming the actors.
Yes.
A brilliant British detective finds that his roommate is the president of the United States. They have detailed discussions about Latin, fountain pens, and butterball turkeys.
Brilliant British detective, butterball turkeys. Okay. Martin Sheen and, oh God, why can't I remember this other guy's name?
You know the first name.
You can.
British detective. Do. Yeah, that's how desperate Dodo is. She's singing and stalling. Martin Foreman. I don't know.
No, Martin Freeman. Martin Freeman and Martin Sheen. Sherlock in the West Wing. All right. Tara.
Yes.
She's got her column, her shoes, her three gal pals, and a vampire boyfriend.
Okay. It's Sarah Jessica Parker. Vampire boyfriend. I don't know.
Wow.
I don't know.
Sarah Michelle
Geller. Of course.
Sex in the City, Buffy the Vampire Slayer. That was an easy one. You missed it. All right. Yeah. Here's Chris Huff can pull into the lead with the correct answer here. And era appropriate for today's show. Blair and Tootie can't deal with their schoolmate, a rom-com obsessed OBGYN.
Oh, okay.
Blair and Tootie can't deal with their schoolmate, a rom-com obsessed OBGYN. You know any part of that?
I do. I just don't know the names. So I can not answer by answering or the reverse. What's her name? Who was on all The right. Office and now she's on and I can't remember.
Oh no.
That's Mindy Cohen.
Yes. Yep.
And Mindy Kaling. Facts of Life and the Mindy Project. All right, no points so far. So we're back
off to
Sarah.
An awesome start, you guys.
Angela Chase's boyfriend turns out to be Rory Gilmore's boyfriend. Hello?
It's to you, Sarah.
Oh, sorry. Jared Leto and Jared Padalecki.
Nice.
First point of the game. Now to Tara.
Yes.
A meth kingpin's unknowing wife turns out to be a half fairy in love with a vampire and a werewolf.
Anna Gunn and Anna Paquin.
Here we go. All right.
Are we supposed to be saying the shows while we
no.
go? Okay.
That was Breaking Bad
and True Blood.
Carrie, Charlotte, and Miranda just can't keep up with their friend who leaks her sex tape and becomes a blight on humanity.
These are not very male-friendly questions that you're asking me.
Sure they are.
They're
just not history-friendly.
My dad watched Sex in the City. I don't know.
Linda Blair and Linda Cohn. I don't know.
That's Kim Cattrall and Kim Kardashian, Sex in the City, and Keeping Up with the Kardashians. Back to Sarah.
Oh, I should
do
know
you
that.
Know who's running the crime scene investigation lab in Las Vegas? Sergeant T.J. Hooker.
Oh, my birthday mate. That is William Peterson of CSI Original Flav and William Shatner of Star Trek Original Flav.
That's correct. That's T.J. Hooker. Okay, to Tara.
Yes.
Down at the beach, the head lifeguard is a neurotic psychiatrist from Seattle.
Okay. Kelsey Grammer, head lifeguard. Kelsey.
I'm going to stop you there because you're already on the wrong track.
Okay.
David Hasselhoff and David Hyde Pierce.
Oh, shit. Yeah. Of course.
A little tricky there. All right, Chris. George, Kramer, and Elaine all constantly hang out at the apartment of Lenny Briscoe.
You know, I always thought it'd be great on Jeopardy, but now I know I'd be really horrible.
All right, just think of George,
talk it out,
Kramer, and Elaine all constantly hang out.
Oh, Jerry Seinfeld and Jerry Orbach.
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
You're just psyching yourself out, Chris.
I am.
Sarah.
Very nervous.
Yeah.
At Tribal Council, a news anchor mansplains it all to you.
Oh. Jeff Probst. For a second, I was like, there's someone else named Peaches. Jeff Probst and Jeff Daniels.
That is Survivor and the Newsroom. Correct.
Nicely done.
Tara.
Yeah.
Dexter's annoying, controlling blonde wife is actually, wait, another annoying, controlling blonde wife.
Nice.
Rob, God bless you. It's Julie Benz from Dexter and Julie Bowen, my nemesis from Modern Family.
Picky. Got to you. All right. This is our last question before the first score break for Chris Huff. Chandler Bing discovers that his mother is Easy Reader.
Easy.
That's good. That's good shit.
Yep.
That's good stuff. His kung fu's good.
Oh. No.
Who's Easy Reader? Oh.
Yeah. Thank God.
All right. Easy Reader is?
Morgan Freeman.
And the mother?
Morgan Fairchild.
Morgan Fairchild.
That is correct. All right. Let's hear the scores here at our first score break. We are quarter way through.
Very close game. Chris has one. I have two. Sarah has three.
All right. Three, two, one. For Sarah, in New York, Sherlock's sidekick is a warrior princess.
Sherlock's sidekick is a warrior princess. That's Lucy Liu of Elementary, and Lucy Lawless of Xena Warrior Princess.
And that is a point.
Nice.
Tara, yes. Charles is in charge of the brand new Enterprise.
Scott Baio of Charles in Charge and Scott Bakula of Enterprise.
Yes, Scott Bakula.
Blah.
Chris Huff, it seemed like a normal day in class with Miss Kerboppel until she ripped off her wig.
What?
Oh, shit.
Yeah. That's a tough one if you don't know voice actors.
Yeah, like Nancy something.
Yeah, no. Anybody?
Marsha Wallace and Marsha Cross.
That's correct. All right, back to Sarah. CJ Craig has a suitor at work. A Kentucky lawman who should not be wearing pants.
CJ Craig has a suitor at work. A Kentucky. Okay. Timothy off of his pants, Oliphant. And Timothy. Oh, fuck. Why can't I remember his last name?
The Ginger.
Busfield.
Yeah.
Correct.
Well done.
Back
to Tara Ariano. Yes. Hannibal Lecter's nemesis is a sardonic MD addicted to painkillers.
Hugh Laurie and Hugh Dancy.
That is correct. Back to Mr. Huff.
That's Doctor.
Sorry. Doctor. Professor. That's
trying
Esquire
to save
Huff.
Some dignity here.
He's a transparent. No, wait. He's actually transparent because he's a ghost.
Oh, I get it.
He's a trans-parent.
Yeah.
No, wait. He's actually transparent because he's a ghost.
Is it Jeffrey something?
It is Jeffrey something. I will give
it's
you that.
It's Jeffrey's and another Jeffrey.
Jeffrey. Well,
Tubin.
A for effort. That's Jeffrey Tambor from Transparent and Jeffrey Dean Morgan from Grey's Anatomy.
Oh, man. That's
back
good.
To Sarah. In Brooklyn, Hannah Horvath does the walk of shame. Shame, shame, ding, ding, ding.
does the walk of shame. Shame. Ding, ding, ding.
Yeah.
Yeah. Bell.
Uh-huh. Okay. So it's Lena Dunham and... Lena Horne. Why not? Oh.
Lena Dunham and Tara?
Lena Headey?
Yeah, Headey. From Game of Thrones.
Oh, right. The scene of Game of Thrones, I could not. I could picture her from Alias, and then I just couldn't pull the name.
Tara?
Yep.
On Tool Time, our host makes AI. Oh, sorry, AI. Oh, God. On Tool Time, our host makes Al.
Yes.
Too much sci-fi this week on Extra Hungry.
Yes.
Construct an evening gown out of hardware and tells him to make it work.
Tim Allen and Tim Gunn.
Correct. All right. Back to Professor Dr. Huff. Leah Remini's schlub husband thinks he's some kind of Hercules. Wow. He actually is Hercules.
Okay. Hold on.
Schlub husband thinks schlub he's some husband. Kind of Hercules. Wait, he actually is Hercules.
Is he? He's a schlub. Oh God. No.
It's Kevin James and Kevin Sorbo from King of Queens and Hercules, the legendary journeys. Okay, Sarah. Beaver's mom turns out to be a sexy genie who lives in a bottle.
Beaver's mom turns out to be a sexy genie.
Yeah.
Who lives in
a bottle. I'll give you a hint. It's not Breaking Bad.
Lives in a bottle. I don't know this one.
Barbara Billingsley from Leave It to Beaver and Barbara Eden from I Dream.
Yeah, I was never going to get Billingsley. Shit.
All right. This is Tatara.
Yep.
A group of scientist nerds hang out with their buddy, Private Gomer Pyle.
Oh, boy.
Jim Nabors and Jim Parsons.
That is good for 1 point.
Nice.
All right. Here's our halfway point score break after this. This is for Dr. Huff. Laverne and Shirley's landlady is a scatterbrain from St. Olaf, Minnesota, and apparently immortal.
Hartman!
Whoa, this is a tough one, man.
St. Olaf, Betty White, and I don't know.
Yeah. The Betty White part was correct. Betty Garrett is the other one. That was a tough one.
Oh, yeah, no way.
All right.
John Hartman. All right. Chris has 1. Sarah has 5. I have 6.
All right. That's halfway through. Starting up again with Sarah D. Bunting. Instead of chatting over cheesecake, Dorothy and Rose have to lip sync for their lives.
Okay. Wow. RuPaul Charles and Rue McClanahan.
That is good for a point. That's great.
It's kind of a cheat, but I think we'll all allow it.
Jane Fonda reluctantly becomes friends with a possessed nun from a haunted asylum.
Say that again.
Jane Fonda reluctantly becomes friends with a possessed nun from a haunted asylum.
Okay. Lily Tomlin and Lily Rabe. I just want to say it's a cheat for Rob to have Rue and RuPaul as if they were the same name. Not that Sarah was cheating. She got that fair and square brilliantly.
And I did say his last name in order to make up for that.
She did.
Her last name.
All right, Chris. Khal Drogo is the leader of the Dothraki people. But more importantly, he's California University student president in full-on Bray mode. Once again, Khal Drogo is a leader of the Dothraki people. But more importantly, he's California Student University president in full-on Bray mode.
Oh, man. I'm so mad I didn't get this one.
Is this a Game of Thrones question? Because I'm like the only person in America who hasn't watched this show.
Yeah.
It's half a Game of Thrones question.
So, yeah.
So you're right. Okay. Jason Momoa.
Sound it out. Yep.
Yeah. And Jason Priestley. That's... Game of Thrones and our good old friend Beverly Hills 90210. Again, with this podcast available for download now. Sarah.
Well done, Dave. Yes.
Lady Olenna Tyrell schemes against the Lannisters and then turns and falls down an elevator shaft.
Okay. Well, the lady the lady who became a grease spot is Rosalind Shay. No, that's the character's name. Shit. What is the actress's name? We just talked about her.
Yep.
She was also in The Hulk. Yeah.
Oh, God.
And her name is Diana Muldaur.
Yeah.
And then the, yeah, fuck yeah. And then the other one's name is Diana Flacoctosin. Wait, give me a second. Diana Rigg.
Yeah.
Wow. I don't think you're going to get
that
it.
That was a roller coaster.
I'm so sorry.
All right.
I'm sorry. That's awesome. Thank
amazing.
You.
Tara.
Yes.
Lorelai Gilmore's controlling mother is a literal member of the fashion police.
Kelly Bishop and Kelly Osborne.
That is correct. Nice. All right. Chris, not only is Chandler Bing a transponster, he sent his own daughter to the upside down. Any clue on that one?
Chris hates us, you guys. He's never coming back.
I hate so much.
Guess now we know how that other season ends.
Matthew Perry from Friends and Matthew Modine from Stranger Things. Okay, back to Sarah. Roseanne's mother constantly regales her with stories from her childhood in Sicily.
Roseanne's mother?
Yeah,
okay,
you don't
so
know that.
Her childhood in Sicily, picture it, 1904, is Estelle Getty.
Yeah.
And then I was not a regular Roseanne watcher, but there's only so many Estelles. So Estelle.
Can I give Sarah a hint?
Sure.
The surname has already been mentioned, it belonging to another person, no relation that I know of.
I can't confirm okay. That is correct.
Estelle. Okay, well, there were only two to choose from. Is it Estelle Parsons?
Yeah.
It is.
Thanks, Tara.
Will that be Tara's undoing? Let's find out. Tara Ariano.
Spoiler.
One of Modern Family's older daughters is replaced by Roseanne's older daughter, and nobody notices.
Sarah Hyland and Sarah Chalk.
Nice.
Correct. All right. To Chris Huff, Pawnee's most dedicated civil servant is junkie whore runaway Jerry Blank.
Formerly Two Stars, One Slot on FameTracker.com, these two.
Yeah, wow. I am drawing such horrible blanks on all
these. Do you know any part of that?
Yes.
You know, all right, tell us what.
No, I. No. Bob Newhart.
Oh, no. Okay, that was Amy Poehler, Parks and Recreation, Amy Sedaris, Strangers with Candy. Sarah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Senior strategist Kent Davison has one question. What you talking about, Willis?
Senior strategist Kent. Okay. I don't think I'm gonna get that one, but maybe by working backwards from Gary Coleman, I can guess that guy's name is Gary Cole.
Ding, ding, ding,
holy
ding.
Correct. Shit. I can't believe I got away with that.
That nicely was done. His character from Veep.
Yep.
Yeah. All right. To Tara.
Yep.
She's a doctor down in Dixie who sings and dances her way to West Covina for an ex.
Rachel Bilson and Rachel Bloom.
That is correct for a point. All right, last question before our three-quarter mark score break. For Chris Huff, Meredith Grey discovers her opinionated best friend is Roseanne's opinionated best friend.
Ooh. Wow.
Oh, okay.
Got it.
It's the Roseanne's best friend.
That's a complicated blonde. One.
That is.
That is Sarah O. Sandra O. Yeah, sorry. And Sandra Bernhard from Roseanne in Grey's Anatomy were the shows. All right. So that is question 36 of 48. We are three quarters done.
All right. Chris has a point and Sarah has 9 points. I have 10 points.
All right. Yay. Close game up at the top. It is Sarah's turn. The new waitress at Mel's Diner is the second wife of an oil tycoon.
Jesus Christ. The second wife of an oil tycoon.
Yes.
And, oh no, the opinionated waitress.
I don't know. I don't know.
No guesses?
Chris, do you? Steel Meal?
Linda Lavin? And... Nope, ain't got it.
I'm not using the steel mill for that. It is not a strategic. Don't ask him to use the steel mill.
All right,
he's eight
sorry.
Points behind,
I thought he might know.
But he can't use them in an effective way. So
okay.
Tara, do you know?
Yes, Linda Evans.
Linda Lavin and Linda Evans.
Oh.
Alice and Dynasty. To Tara.
Yes.
The Bradys. Dallas. Oh, sorry. The Bradys discover their youngest daughter is the 10-time married and 19-time nominated diva of Pine Valley.
Susan Lucci. And what was the first part of the clue?
The Bradys discover their youngest daughter is the 10-time married and 19-time nominated diva of Pine Valley.
Susan Olsen?
Yes. Okay. Wow.
Nice.
Recently in the news for being homophobic on her radio show that she just got fired from.
Yeah, great.
Oh, boo.
All right. Chris Huff, the ER's chiming pediatrician, turns out to be a starship helmsman from the 23rd century.
Can I just say that I was literally less nervous defending my dissertation than I am right now playing this game.
Now,
we're going to take your PhD back if you don't.
I will.
Up a little.
I will remind
say,
you that
sounds
actors
easy.
Do not show up twice in this game.
The ER's charming pediatrician
turns out to be a starship helmsman from the 23rd century.
I don't know, George Clooney and George Takei.
See?
Yay!
What? No, seriously? Wow.
Yes.
That's how it goes. All right, Sarah D. Bunting, the Bundy's neighbor, turns out to have a past. He ran a bar in Boston.
Oh, shit. Oh, no. Okay, Ted Danson, and is it the show killer, Ted McGinley?
Yep.
He sure is.
Oh, what a legacy. All right, Tara Ariano.
Yes.
The new coach of the Cheerios is Dr. Quinn Medicine Woman.
Okay, Stephanie Seymour. I don't know who the other Stephanie is. So.
Jane Seymour, Jane Lynch.
Shit, Jane.
Stephanie Seymour is a model?
Yes, she is. All from right. The November Rain video, if I recall correctly.
Fuck yeah. Yes, this is everywhere.
All right, this is to Chris. The vice president and now the president is a former maid from... Vermont Inn, from a Vermont Inn. I'll read that again. The vice president and now the president is a former maid from a Vermont Inn.
Yep, got them exactly in my head, and I could not tell you their names if my life depended on it.
Either one?
Nope.
That second one is kind of a... you know, back in the mist of time, but that was Julia Louis-Dreyfus from Veep. And Julia Duffy from Newhart.
Duffy.
All right, back to Sarah. The kindly Cabot Cove novelist turns out to be a voodoo queen. Turns out to be voodoo queen Marie Laveau.
I would watch that, actually.
Yeah.
I'd watch the hell out of that. That's Angela Lansbury of Murder, She Wrote, and Angela Bassett of Voodoo, She Wrote. Just kidding. American Horror Story.
Voodoo, She Wrote would be kind of great too, actually.
Yeah, would also watch that.
Especially for like the spooky take on the theme song for the credits. That'd be great.
Yep.
Yeah. Back to Tara Ariano.
Yes.
The head of this New Jersey mafia family is a skittish, film-obsessed teen with an enormous forehead. Wow.
Rob, you're such a bitch sometimes. James Gandolfini of The Sopranos and James Vanderbeek of Dawson's Creek.
That was like the most Sarah Tara
that's
question
very good.
That ever existed. Feeny and the Beak.
All right. To Chris, when teen Scott McCall transforms, he doesn't turn into a wolf. He turns into Medea.
Oh, Chris.
You're not
No, you're not.
I'll put you out of your misery there. That was Tyler Posey and Tyler Perry.
Yeah.
Posey and Perry together again. Everybody's last question coming up. What are the scores, please?
All right. Chris has 2 points. Sarah has 11 points. I have 12 points.
All right. So Sarah, You need to get this. Are you ready? You know what Carolyn likes to do in the city? Sang.
Caroline
likes to do in the city. Sang. I'm just going to, you know, it's all caps. And it's got an S and a few A's and a few N's and a G.
Okay.
Yeah, and it's all caps. And an exclamation point at the end of that one.
I believe you. And, oh, God. She was in Back to the Future. Fuck, help. It's the Alex P. Keaton connection. Okay. Leah Thompson. And the other one must be Leah Michelle of Glee.
Yeah, correct. Caroline in the city. Not whatever I said.
Yes, Caroline.
No one watched it. It's fine.
All right.
I watched it.
Oh, Tara.
I don't know why.
I don't either.
All right. This is for Tara.
Yes.
When things get too crazy around Downton, Lady Grantham twitches her nose and uses her witchcraft.
Elizabeth McGovern and Elizabeth Montgomery.
That is correct. Nice. Nicely done. All right, last question of the game for Mr. Huff. Oh, no. Okay, Mr. Huff. Tim and Jill Taylor discovered that the middle son is Dracula. Blah.
I don't know. Let's go with Benedict Cumberbatch and Benedict Arnold.
You're not even trying.
Points for style.
Jonathan Taylor Thomas from Home Improvement. And
which
Jonathan Rhys-Meyers from Dracula. He was once in the Tudors, but now he's stock market investing vampire from Old World challenging oil oligarchies.
Not anymore.
Yeah, he still exists.
You're really starting
mind.
To sound more and more like Gru with this imitation. This is not a complaint. I'm just letting you know.
Tiebreakers for shits and giggles?
Sure.
All
sure.
Right. I'm going to put steel mills for each one of these. I got two of them.
Ooh.
First person to shout out the answer wins.
Okay.
These are, tough. All right. Edith Bunker's cranky husband turns out to be a giant yellow bird. Anybody?
Carol O'Connor and Carol Spinney.
Wow. Nicely done. That's
good
a steel
job.
Mill for Tara.
Very nice.
Shits and giggles for Dave points, but we're going with a steel meal. The sugar baker's eccentric friend Bernice shows Dylan McKay how to ride Shadowcaster, if you know what I mean.
She was she's in the OA also. She plays the mom. I'll sit this one out since I got the last one.
Oh, it's the Borg Queen. It's Anne someone, but I don't know the other one either.
No. Tara, you can still get it.
It's not Anne. Alice Ghostly and Alice Krige. I don't know how to pronounce
Krieg
her name.
Krieg or something. Yeah.
Krieg.
Yeah.
Krieg.
Correct. Well done, Ariana.
Indeed.
Tara! Tara.
Just glad I didn't get my ass kicked this time.
That was a close one. That was
fun.
That is it for another episode of Extra Hot Great and another calendar year for us, too. We'll be back soon with minis, of course, with Chris Huff all this week. And then after that, until the new year, a mini every day that you usually expect something from us. So we'll see you again soon. We'll be recording again 2017.
We talked about the Man in the High Castle.
Yeah, I wasn't going to do
blah,
that.
Blah, blah. Okay. Yeah, well, yeah. Anyway.
I am now going to say, remember... I am David T. Cole, and on behalf of Tara Ariano,
Sha-la-la-la.
Sarah D. Bunting,
thanks for listening this year,
and Dr. Chris Huff.
So hot in Florida right now.
Thanks for listening, everybody. We'll see you next time right here on Extra Hot Great.
This man is clearly deluded. The stress of seeing his friend accused. Our sincerest apologies, Kasura-san. We'll leave now.
This has been a production of the Previously.tv Podcast Network.